From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made over this past weekend when President Trump took to Twitter to go after a Washington Post reporter. That reporter is Dave Weigel. Weigel posted a picture of an arena with many empty seats in Florida, and he mused that Trump wasn't drawing big crowds. But the picture does turn out to have been taken significantly before Trump's event in Pensacola. Well, within 20 minutes, Weigel apologized on Twitter and said it was fair to call him out. He acknowledged the error. For Trump, that was not good enough. Trump tweeted multiple times, one time tweeting, quote, "Weigel just admitted his picture was a fake. He should be fired," end quote. And it wasn't the first time he had done something like this. In all of his tweets, Trump tagged Dave Weigel, effectively asking his supporters to inundate Weigel with criticism. It's kind of a way of burying someone on Twitter. And Weigel was hit with thousands of angry tweets. I'm looking at some of them now. I cannot read some of the most vulgar, but some were threatening. And MSNBC producer Kyle Griffin responded to this by saying, quote, "The president calling for a journalist to be fired seems like a public threat to the First Amendment," end quote. Is he right? A month ago, lawyer and tech writer Tim Wu wrote a piece for the New York Times arguing that the First Amendment is failing in the age of social media and it badly needs to be reinvigorated. But today, writing for Cato, John Samples responded that on balance, social media and the First Amendment are getting along just fine. So let's talk about all of that this hour. My guests include Jack Rosenberry, professor of media and communication at St. John Fisher College. Jack, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Evan. Good to be back.
Scott Maloof is a social media attorney. Back with us as well here. Scott, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
Jack, I'll start with you here. And Phil Griffin, Kyle Griffin from MSNBC, he's a producer, raising this point, saying the president isn't just upset with the report. He's calling for a firing. He knows what he's doing by tagging a reporter. He wants his supporters to bury that guy and to kind of take him off of offline, or, you know, kind of inundate his mentions. And he thinks that that maybe is a threat to the First Amendment. Do you agree?
Well, in a legal sense, no. I mean, the First Amendment is there, and it's not going anywhere. Everyone has a right to comment, and, you know, that includes reporters, that includes every individual citizen, that includes the president. So, I mean, legally, I don't see anything going wrong here or being done wrong. Ethically, morally, social norms, political norms, are those being violated when the president, you know, basically calls for a reporter to be fired? You know, arguably, I think there are issues of ethics and norms, but, you know, legally, it's, you know, the president's within his bounds to say what he wants to say in terms of criticizing people in the media.
Is it okay with you for the president to call for reporters to be fired?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, I think that that's, you know, there are many, many things that the president has said, especially on Twitter, but also in some of his public statements and some of his rallies and things like that, where he has, you know, vigorously attacked the free press, the press. And, you know, the notion of the First Amendment is to provide robust commentary about what goes on in society, including commentary about what our government officials are doing. And it's okay to not like that. President Trump is not the first politician at any level who has been upset at times about things that have been reported about him. The vigor with which he attacks the media is kind of a new thing, I think, for presidents. But, so absolutely, I think he shouldn't be doing it.
All right, listeners, if you want to weigh in on this as we talk about the president's use of social media, we talk about what the First Amendment does and does not do, how it applies to social and other forms here, 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Scott Maloof, what would you say to the MSNBC producer who raised all of this weekend's episode by saying, hey, that seems like a public threat to the First Amendment?
You know, I think the challenge is always for me, Evan, as you know, is definitions. And I would go back to what the president did and say, what exactly was your behavior? What did you call for? You know, if he said, I don't like this behavior, and I ask folks to object to the Washington Post and to how it runs its operation, I think, you know, that's pretty protected versus stuff that goes in the other line where if he'd said, I want people to, you know, go to this person's house and, you know, protest 24/7, keep all the neighbors up, you know, that veers much closer to that harassment line. And so I think the challenge is always, how does it shake out and what was the intent? And I think that's the real challenge what we see, because clamping down on either side creates unintended consequences.
I do not want to put you in the position of role-playing the president's attorney, but I'm going – I know. Because look, my instinct in this as a journalist is to say what the president did is gauche at best, problematic in terms of the norms of the office, and I understand Jack's point there. But I'm not sure I see what Kyle Griffin is saying, that it's a threat to the First Amendment. Now, there are other issues we're about to work through when it comes to First Amendment issues. However, let's just play this out here. Let's say I'm an attorney for the Washington Post or Dave Weigel himself, who feels harassed by thousands upon thousands of Twitter mentions that came from the president's followers because the president multiple times linked directly to Dave Weigel and essentially told, I mean, his followers may know what the president wants. So here's just three examples of what people were writing to Dave Weigel. Oh boy, I can't even, I'm not even sure I can read this. So there's one. This person writes to Dave Weigel, as if you didn't do it on purpose after blanking Obama for so many years and having had a crisis when crooked Hillary rightfully lost. Wait till she gets sent to jail. Guantanamo would be a minimum for her. There's one. What an idiot you are, Dave Weigel. Where can I send you a coloring book, Play-Doh, and a My Little Pony stuffed animal to hug? The Washington Post needs to discipline you for your bias and lack of journalistic integrity and credibility. Then here's a third one. You knew very well what you were doing there. It's not the first time these fake photos have been posted by blank media. That's just three examples upon thousands upon thousands. So let's say I'm Weigel's attorney. And I say, look, Your Honor, I'm sorry, but that's harassment, because the president knew that his supporters would do that, wanted them to do that, got that result, and that's harassment. And there should be a penalty for that. Mm-hmm. What's the argument against?
Well, I think if only, you know, we all had that kind of power to direct people and we know what they're going to do and we know how they're going to execute it. I'd say, you know, look, we have known since time immemorial, presidents' words move markets. You know, when presidents speak, people do listen. But the president is not responsible for every individual who goes out and takes it upon themselves. You know, what if you have a school teacher who tweets at this person and says, you know, my students are in second grade and I tell them to tell the truth and be accurate with their facts, and 10,000 school teachers sent that to him. Does that make it okay? I mean, that's what I think the president would say. Look, I did this and, you know, people reacted independently and I'm not responsible for that. I kind of go back to the norms. I think that's the real challenge of the situation we're in, is that people keep pushing the envelope and affecting norms. Calling anybody out individually on social media, whether it's the president or other folks, you know, can be a real challenging act, because you realize there are some small subset of people who are going to do things incorrectly. And then, like, the Pizzagate was a good example, mm-hmm. where the guy drove up from North Carolina. To me, I'm much more concerned with, you know, that one individual who's physically going someplace. But I can understand where, you know, Mr. Weigel would say, this is insane. My phone is blowing up. I can't do my job. It's distracting me. And it is undermining our ability to have a civil discussion about substantive issues.
All right. So a couple of other points before we get to these dueling opinion pieces on whether the First Amendment is failing in the age of social media. We'll get there in a minute. But here's a separate issue with President Trump. And I want to get both of your takes on this, both from maybe a legal perspective, but also from a norms perspective. President Trump has blocked a number of just common citizens, mm-hmm. because he didn't like what they tweeted about him. We've seen this in the media. The president has blocked some journalists. He's blocked some people in the business world. He's blocked some just common Twitter users because he doesn't like what they have tweeted. Scott, is the president suppressing people's right to gain information from, you know, an elected head of state? Is that a violation in a way?
Well, you know, unsurprisingly, there's a lawsuit on this. The Knight First Amendment Institute filed a claim on behalf of 7 Twitter users.
By the way, I did not even, this just came to me while we're sitting here. And of course, Scott knows everything that's going on with this. But go ahead, Scott. Of course you know. I didn't even warn you I was going to ask about this. Go ahead.
Yeah, I know. I feel like I need to get you to send me a retainer on these.
Yeah, I know. Nothing can stump you. All right, so what's going on with this?
So basically, first of all, let's just be very clear about what we're talking about. We're not talking about the account, the official account. We're not talking about at POTUS. That's very simple. We're not talking about an official account. We're talking about President Trump's real Donald Trump account. So the private account that he had before he ran for office, you know, and has been using for years. But that account has been used, you know, to make announcements, to say things. So the Knight First Amendment Institute, on behalf of seven private individuals, I believe, filed a suit and said, look, in essence, that account is a public forum. It's no different than, you know, a public university where a lot of those particular protests, you know, have happened. And by it being a public forum, you, the president, cannot block these users because it's no different than keeping people from going to the public square and speaking. Now, the defense to that, you know, has been that, no, this is a private account, existed before, and it's not a public forum. And so that's the real challenge. Now, a couple of—
I don't buy that, by the way. But, yeah,
well, interestingly, you're in some powerful company. Lawrence Tribe, who is a Harvard Law professor, and then Erwin Chemerinsky. And Professor Chemerinsky, he literally did write the book on constitutional law. He is well known for that. I used his book. And they're on the side of the Knight First Amendment Institute saying this is a public forum. And there was a recent different case where there's some favorable stuff has come down on that. But we don't know. And I guess my take would be it's relatively easy with the president, but what happens when we're talking about a town supervisor or somebody who's not particularly sophisticated who uses their own account? Say they run for office and then they get into office and they start using their personal account. Are we going to have a situation where they can't block somebody who's abusive and who says things? And this kind of actually loops back to where you started. There has been a case that someone could be convicted of harassment for continuing to email a town official, you know, when they were instructed not to. But again, that was not about the quality of the speech as the the volume of it. Okay. How many?
All right. So the shorter than version of this, where we're going is, are we going to see the president allowed to block people in the future?
It's going to be a tough call. I think it's going to come down against him. And I think it's going to be seen that, you know, his use of this account is very much one and the same as using that public account. And it may just be, could just be the volume of tweets and the fact that he does make official announcements.
He does, yeah.
That's really, it's a really close, tough call.
I would ask you how you feel about it, but, you know, you're here to be the analyst of what you think here.
But, you know, these close ones, those are the ones that make First Amendment cases. That's what makes the First Amendment such a tough thing.
Jack Rosenberry, how do you feel about the president blocking average citizens on Twitter?
I would have to say that, you know, in line, if you, on the one hand, I think, you know, it's his personal account. And, you know, I should be able to do it with my personal account, my personal Twitter account, what I want to do. You should be able to do what you want to do.
Yeah, but it takes a lot to get me to block somebody, but when I do get to that point, it feels so good. So I'm with you there.
Yeah. But, you know, on the other hand, when you seek publicity on your own behalf through any particular forum, and Twitter being, you know, a very powerful and popular forum that the president has adopted, I think you have to kind of take the good with the bad and accept that maybe your privacy or your ability to avoid criticism is lower than, you know, the average citizen who only has a few hundred followers versus, you know, you're the president and you have 44 million followers.
And I think some of the challenge is the ease of these forums. You know, it's so easy to set up a Twitter account. It's so easy to create your own page. And not just for politicians, but in the workplace as well. And we're seeing a lot of employers, a lot of organizations wrestle with the challenge that employees have side gigs, have their own accounts, and all of these things can impact both in the workplace and out and how people relate to them.
It does make me wonder, Jack, just how much time he's spending on Twitter to actually be interested in blocking people. I mean, it's got to be really on there quite a bit.
Yeah, and the other thing is, I wonder, you know, it's pretty well documented that he doesn't completely control the account. He has aides who can log in, you know, Dan Scavino being one. He had the issue where, the incident where one of his lawyers said he drafted the tweet. Well, who actually typed it into the phone? Who actually sent it out? So I wonder how much of the blocking is being done by some of these other individuals on their own behalf rather than the president making the decision himself. I mean, we have no way of knowing that, but, you know, we do know that he's not the only person typing into that account.
But this is where, now I got to turn back to the lawyer, because we have seen this come up in various cases. There was, and I mean cases, instances, and I'm sure legal cases eventually, if not already, but instances in which public leaders, it's happened here in Rochester, say, that must have been an aide who jumped on my Facebook account. That must have been an aide who posted that tweet. Ultimately, Scott, aren't we responsible if it comes from us? And is there two things? Is there personal responsibility and then legal responsibility there?
Well, and again, that's what goes back to the original question we asked is, what's the role of that particular account? Is it a public account, in which case, you know, absolutely, it doesn't matter whether it's you, the office holder, or your lowest level assistant who did it, versus a personal account where that second part, you know, was my assistant, could be a factor.
Okay. Well, if you see it from me, it's coming from me. I do want to say that. Now, there's another issue that's come up recently that I tend to, personally, I kind of side with writers like David French, who is a conservative writer for the National Review, who have publicly complained about Twitter's habit lately of taking away blue check marks from people like Richard Spencer, who is one of the leaders of the alt-right movement. You know, David French has said, you don't have to like Richard Spencer or the alt-right. You don't have to like anybody. The blue check mark is supposed to be about verification of someone being who they say they are, as opposed to endorsement of message. And that there becomes something a little bit too much like controlling opinions or ideas or endorsing certain opinions and not others that David French and others have been uncomfortable with. And I have to say, I agree. Scott, what's going on there?
So basically what we've seen is, and this is particularly unique to Twitter, Twitter is a relatively open platform, and people have called for individuals like Richard Spencer, who's a known, apparently, neo-Nazi, for Twitter to take away the blue check mark. The blue check mark signifies this person is who they say they are. So when you go to Evan Dawson, it's the Evan Dawson with XXI.
It's amazing, by the way, I'm still waiting for my blue check mark.
It's so funny. Every time you talk about the blue check mark, everybody in the room goes, yeah, where's mine?
I know. That's exactly right. That's me there. But okay, so, but it's about verification.
Right, it's like the phone book. You know, you open the phone book, you want to know Smith Inc. is the Smith Inc. you want.
Yeah.
But, you know, people have pushed back and said, well, no, this is you, Twitter, normalizing this kind of behavior. We don't like this particular message this person has. And by giving this blue check mark, you're adding some authenticity, some, you know, some gravitas to the person. And I think that's a real confusion. I think I agree with you. It's a problem. Because if you look at the flip side, once you get that blue check mark, you know, then you say, look, you know, thousands of people are finding you. You are more responsible for your speech. If your intern did it and it's a private account, but you have a blue check mark, that's something that you need to be more thoughtful about. So I think that's a very short-sighted, you know, way to look at it, to say, take this away because I don't like this particular person's speech. And I think that's a real problem we're having a lot of these internet discussions is the bigger picture gets pulled away, and it's just one tiny argument.
Jack, when your students ask, well, but should we be allowing the Richard Spencers of the world to be tweeting and speaking, et cetera? I mean, isn't Twitter just naturally responding to Richard Spencer the way anybody would who finds his views aberrant? What do you think?
Well, if you're going to be an open platform, then be an open platform. You know, I don't think that Twitter, you know, should ban individuals because of the content of their speech, although I guess legally they would be allowed to because they're a private entity. That's not like the government preventing someone from speaking. But again, it comes back to, you know, do you want to be an open platform or not? And if you want to be an open platform, then, you know, by picking and choosing who gets to be on it and who doesn't, you know, violate your own kind of ethos of being an open platform.
Mm-hmm. Scott?
I think another problem is the best, you know, reagent to speech that we don't like is more speech thoughtful responses. And I think when you take away those blue check marks or you take away the platform, you stop that discussion. You stop that response where somebody says, here is the harmful thing that's occurred because of what you said. So I think you got to be very careful of saying taking away the platform is going to result in something good. In fact, it's going to be something bad. And secondly, it's a very short-sighted view. You know, if you think that when you take somebody and kick them off at Twitter, they're not going to go find an alternative platform, they are going to go look for that.
There's an example locally. A speech case came up locally when we saw the racist flyers that were placed on driveways in Pittsford and Brighton. And a lot of people were deeply offended by that. That was in the fall of 2016. And one of the things we heard from Chris Thomas, local attorney, Scott Maloof, many others who had conversations about this is, you know, this is not to endorse at all the content in those flyers. But maybe the most effective response is more speech and a counter of speech that grows even more powerful and louder. Well, what we saw come out of that was the creation of Pits Forward, an organization that celebrates diversity and inclusion there. And then one of the people who helped found Pits Forward ran for office and won, the first person of color to win on the Pittsford Town Board. Directly because of that, Scott, is that an example of more speech, you know, is the better solution as opposed to eliminating speech?
Yeah, that's the perfect example of it. And it's also a great example of how communities, the smaller community, the more your response can be nuanced and your response can be direct as opposed to, you know, this thing happened across the country. I can't affect an election there, but boy, I can affect one in my backyard.
All right, listeners, I would love to hear from you on what you think about various issues that we're discussing here. And I want to read a couple of comments that have come in via email here. If you want to call the program, you know, maybe you're somebody who thinks, boy, somebody should throw the president's phone in the lake. But maybe you're somebody who thinks it's at least valuable to get a little insight into how he thinks about the world, which is what I think. The more he tweets, the more we at least see how he is interpreting the world in a pretty unfiltered way. I think that's valuable. 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. 263-9994. A couple of emails from a listener who says, I seem to remember Obama's administration actively spying on reporters. Maybe there should have been a penalty for that. And he says, I think Trump can block anyone he wants on his personal Twitter account, the same as Hillary can delete any email from her email server that she had in her basement for her government account. It always comes back to Hillary's emails. But let me just hit that first part. You know, progressives might not love to hear this, but the Obama administration's record on press freedom, or at least freedom of information, is not very good. Columbia Journalism Review has said just as much there, Jack, and this is where we need to be consistent. Now, I'm not saying it's the same as what we're seeing, and there's no way I can imagine George W. Bush or Barack Obama or George H.W. Bush or Bill Clinton or any president in recent memory actively calling out reporters to be fired or to say that maybe we need to loosen libel laws. We didn't see that. But the Obama administration's record isn't great on press freedom either. If Trump supporters want to hear that, okay, you've got that. At least
no, that's true. That you know, certain lack of transparency, lack of access to information, pursuit of leakers under espionage laws. I mean, all of that happened under the Obama administration as well. So yeah, the left is not.
Perfect, you know, on
not perfect
sunshine
in that
issues.
Regard, yeah.
Yes, exactly. Scott?
And I just want to point out that response you read from the listener was a perfect example of how the First Amendment works. You know, it was witty, it was funny, it drew in something that none of us had mentioned. That's why you need it, because there are literally, when you get on social media, if you spend more time listening, you realize your perspective is one amongst, you know, literally thousands. And that's why you want to have the ability to debate.
All right, let me grab a phone call. This is in Rochester. This is Kwesi on the phone. Go ahead.
Yes, hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, I just had a quick comment. I heard a lot of time journalists saying it's a big issue if the president is criticizing or even recommending firing of journalists if he felt they did something towards him. I'm trying to figure out what is the issue with that, because, I mean, he still doesn't have the power to fire anyone. He does have the right to his opinion. I don't believe any news organization or any internet person or anything would take his direction to say, like, oh, I have to fire this person because the president said so. I think it just fuels people to come out and speak out even more.
Yeah, it's an interesting idea. Scott, what do you think?
Well, I think the challenge is we've seen a firing is often the response to many situations where people don't like a particular speech. You know, say it's an employee who posts something and the organization quickly fires them. You know, I think the challenge is to be, we got to move away from that norm and say, you know what, case by case basis, and see what's really the best situation.
Well, another listener, thank you, Questy, for the phone call. And it's 844-295-TALK if you want to weigh in there. Joel writes to us and says, hasn't Trump violated the Twitter rules for abusive behavior and graphic violence and adult content and violence and physical harm and abuse and hateful conduct, etc.? Scott?
You know, it'd be a full-time job just following all the things that the president posts and deciding that. I think this points to a really interesting question, which is, you know, how do you put the rules and enforce the rules across so many different users, whether it's somebody who's a 15-year-old and they have 10 followers to the president of the United States? I mean, maybe there are some tweets in there that could get an account suspended. But if you're sitting there at Twitter, you say, you know what, this is still a valuable public debate. We've got to move it forward. But I can't say definitively, oh, these particular ones violate it.
Yeah, Jack, let's move away from the legal side of it there. How do you feel about the relationship between this president and reporters? Because the previous emailer is correct, as we said. The Obama, I don't know any presidential administration who I would point to and say, boy, they are the model on sunlight and open access and public information. It hasn't been good. And the higher up you go in government, that tends to be the case. That's just at least been my experience. But this is, at least in my view, concerning for journalists who feel like the profession is under assault in a way that is trying to diminish any public standing or public opinion of it, to sort of invalidate journalism. And that is, to me, new. How do you view it?
Yeah, I would agree with you that that is a new and kind of disturbing development. One of the president's tweets that I saw this morning said, the New York Times did a story in yesterday's paper that sought to chronicle his day. You know, literally from sunrise to, from getting out of bed to going to bed. And he's like, no, that's all wrong. You know, the failing New York Times, as he loves to refer to it, you know, got it wrong. I don't watch 4 hours of television a day, more fake news. So, you know, the term fake news, the president tends to apply to any news that is critical of him. And he tends to say, well, the only news that's out there that's not fake is Fox News and Fox and Friends, which is known to be very kind of positive toward him. So, yeah, the notion of trying to undermine what Washington Post media columnist Margaret Sullivan calls the reality-based media is brand new, I think, in terms of our public discourse and a president doing it and kind of a disturbing thing.
And then the question becomes, I think, Jack, and I'll come back to your phone calls in just a second. What if the president is successful in convincing a large number of Americans that the media is not to be trusted, that journalists are only partisan, that everything is fake or there's a lot of fake news out there, and that you can trust me, the real news comes from government? Well, in Denver, there's a Rochesterian who's the lead anchor out in Denver for the number one radio stations out there. That's Kyle Clark. And he mentioned just a few days ago in Denver, the Denver Police Department is now attacking local media, saying, we're creating our own news arm. You should get all the news that you need about related issues from the Denver police only. And Kyle's response to that was, I don't care your political background. That is not what the police ought to be doing. Nothing wrong with a news release or information. But they're trying to circumvent actual journalism, and that can be dangerous. The problem is some of this stuff is sticking. Some people think, well, yes, now I'll just turn to the police and not journalists. Now I'll just turn to government and not journalists. And if it feels good now because your guys are in power, wait till the next election is kind of how I viewed these. What do you think?
Yeah. You know, the main value to me, again, as a former journalist and as a journalism professor, the main value to me that journalism brings to the public discussion is the notion of independence. And government is entitled to put out its views in news releases, in content on government websites, as is a corporation, as is a nonprofit agency. And that's not to say that that's not interesting and important and valuable information sometimes, but it's also not independent. And so for the police department in Denver to say, you know, don't trust what you read in the Denver Post, only trust what you see on our website, removes that sense of any sort of independence and accountability toward the information going into the public discussion.
Yeah, we don't want state-run television. We don't want state-run media. And that's something to be avoided for so many good reasons. But let me do this. Let's get back to Rocky and Ithaca. Shauna and Rochester, we'll come to you in a moment. And after our only break of the hour, we come back to a conversation on the First Amendment, modern journalism, social media, the president's tweets, and so much more. And we'll kind of wade through what John Samples and Tim Wu went back and forth on. Is Twitter killing the First Amendment? Is the First Amendment under threat in this country? Or is social media actually bolstering speech and helping with speech? So very competing views here. Jack Rosenberry is a professor of media and communication at St. John Fisher College. Scott Maloof is a social media attorney. And we're back to your phone calls and more next. Coming up in our second hour, a local artist wanted to know why there were so few women depicted in art, icons, and statues around the University of Rochester. She decided to create a series of murals called Her Voice Carries. She features local women from various backgrounds, and you can see the murals now. You will meet some of the women and hear about the themes coming up next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let's get to Shauna in Rochester next on the phone. Go ahead, Shauna.
Twitter offers us, as it is now, offers us the possibility of getting a look into the president's mind, because I don't know of any situation before where the president talked to the world at large without a journalist in the middle somewhere. And I think that's fantastic. I actually am not a Trump supporter, and I think he makes a fool of himself every time he does it, but that's his choice. If I were one of his supporters in the White House, I'd say, could you confine your tweeting to daytime, because he doesn't seem to do as much. It's those 4 a.m. tweets that really are so unfortunate from my point of view, from a president. But they are the president's thinking without anybody filtering it.
Yeah, Shauna, thank you for the phone call. In fact, that's interesting, the whole 4 a.m. He was tweeting at 3 a.m. a couple of weeks ago about something, and those timestamps can be pesky, but you know, everyone's got a different schedule. Who am I to judge? I'm not going to judge the president or anybody else when you want to tweet or what your day was. That's not my life.
Well, also, we don't
go ahead, Scott.
Yeah, just real quickly, we also don't know if they're using a tool that moves the schedule, so you don't. You know,
good point.
You can stack them all up. So,
good point there. So, but Jack, that just goes back to the idea of at least this tool gives us that window that so much of politics is really sanitized. You know, journalists have to deal with walls of PR people, carefully sanitized press releases, rehearsed sound bites. I mean, this is the least rehearsed thing, so I'm a little surprised that people complain about it after all of the complaining about how rehearsed politics is.
Yeah, well, politicians have always sought that unfiltered and direct voice. I mean, probably going back to FDR and the fireside chats, right? And, you know, presidents just commanding, you know, calling the networks and saying, I want 3 hours of TV, or not 3 hours, but I want TV time tonight to talk about whatever. You know, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, lots of people have done that. Twitter, I think you're right. It kind of changes the nature of the game a little bit, but getting that unfiltered look, I would agree, has value.
Careful what you wish for. I mean, because, you know, then we start taking the tweets out of president's hands, and you get back to that really sanitized, scrubbed up, careful verse. I at least want to know. You don't have to like what you're hearing, but I do want to know. Let me read from a couple of pieces that came out recently. This is from Tim Wu, who is a lawyer and not only kind of a tech mind. Tim is largely credited with creating the term net neutrality. Of course, he ran for lieutenant governor in the Green Party for New York State. And his piece in the New York Times about a month ago was titled, How Twitter Killed the First Amendment. And I want to read four or five paragraphs there, and we'll get our guest take. He says, in this age of new censorship and blunt manipulation of political speech, where is the First Amendment? Americans like to think of it as the great protector of the press and of public debate. Yet it seems to have become a bit player, confined to a narrow and often irrelevant role. So it is time to ask, Is the First Amendment obsolete? And if so, what can be done? These questions arise because the jurisprudence of the First Amendment was written for a different set of problems in a very different world. The First Amendment was ignored for much of American history, coming to life only in the 1920s, thanks to the courage of judges like Learned Hand, Louis Brandeis, and Oliver Wendell Holmes. Courts and civil libertarians used the amendment to protect speakers from government prosecution and censorship as it was practiced in the 20th century, such as the arrest of pamphleteers and the seizure of anarchist newspapers by the post office. But in the 21st century, censorship works differently. The complete suppression of dissenting speech isn't feasible in our cheap speech era. Instead, the world's most sophisticated censors, including Russia and China, have spent a decade pioneering tools and techniques that are better suited to the internet age. And unfortunately, those new censorship tools have become unwelcome imports here in the United States with catastrophic results for our democracy. The Russian government was among the first to recognize that speech itself could be used as a tool of suppression and control. The agents of its web brigade, often called the Troll Army, disseminate pro-government news, generate false stories, and coordinate swarm attacks on critics of the government. The Chinese government has perfected reverse censorship, whereby disfavored speech is disowned, drowned out by floods of distraction or pro-government sentiment. As the journalist Peter Pomerantsev writes, these techniques employ information in weaponized terms as a tool to confuse, blackmail, demoralize, subvert, and paralyze. End quote. That's how he sees the landscape. Scott Maloof, you know, before the hour began, you and I were kind of going over some of Tim's ideas, and you said these same alarms were raised at various points in media technological progression, yes?
Yeah, I mean, and first off, anytime you can quote Learned Hand, you know, that's a good day, right?
Sure.
His parents pretty much set him up to be a judge when they gave him that name, right?
Learned Hand. But it's a stage name. Can't be right.
But two, you know, the real challenge, I think, is in looking at what Tim Wu wrote there, you know, is kind of picking apart what we're talking about, you know, with regard to Russians posting fake news or Chinese, you know, tools to flood with positive news. I think that, you know, one of the first things to say is, okay, we are having these discussions on platforms, on Facebook, on Twitter, and things like that. And so what technological tools may provide some ways to tackle that, you know, and that's, and again, they're working on that presumably, and that's an ongoing process. It's not perfect. No one should ever say, hey, tech companies, just magic wand this and solve it. But the second thing is, I think you don't want to take those two things and make that the driving First Amendment issue. You know, instead, we have to say, is it a concern? Yes. How much can we address with technology? Yes. And then let's get to the First Amendment analysis.
Okay. Jack?
Yeah, I don't see how he's conflating censorship or prior restraint, which the First Amendment expressly prohibits, with, I like his term, weaponized information, but then to say that that's the same as or you know, equivalent to government restraint of information in violation of the First Amendment, I mean, I think he's kind of making a leap of something there that I'm not sure I can completely see the two as equivalent the way he does.
Sure, and it sounds to me like what Jack and Scott are saying is, you know, weaponized information is a term of art there, but there's also a marketplace of speech. And then the more we learn about how governments or organizations try to weaponize or use information or use platforms, the better educated we can be. And we need to counter that kind of speech with more information, better education, media education, yeah. Media literacy, maybe.
Yes, and the initial, you know, the field of communication studies, you know, the discipline of communication as a scholarly pursuit really began with the study of propaganda in the 20s. I mean, so this has been with us for a long time. The platforms such as Facebook and Twitter and the way information can circulate at warp speed now compared to, you know, waiting for it to come out in the newspaper the next day or be produced on the radio as it was in the 20s, changes the equation some. But yeah, it's just kind of a new articulation of a problem that's been with us for a long time in terms of our our public discourse.
And just picking up on what you said, where we talked about, you know, how this can veer into concerns about, you know, suppressing speech. You know, let's take the person who emailed you and brought up Hillary, right? You know, very often you see this discussion between, you know, Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump. You know, you could easily see someone saying, well, now you're distracting from the issue that Evan started talking about by bringing her into it. Whereas that person's use was very witty and was bringing a countervailing countervailing point. So I think you have to be super careful about saying, you know, this is the Russian troll army versus somebody who says, I'm super focused on this one issue and that's all I'm going to talk about.
Now, speaking of the Russian troll or bot army, if you're wondering what Tim Wu thinks we should do about this, this is where, let me also say in fairness to Tim Wu, I'm reading from his New York Times op-ed, which has a limited word count. He's not here on the program, and Tim Wu is far smarter than I could ever hope to be and knows much more than I do about these issues. But I think there's some vagueness here, and maybe our guests will either agree or disagree, but in terms of what Tim Wu thinks we should do in terms of the First Amendment going forward, he writes, first, it is an imperative that law enforcement and lawmakers do more to protect journalists and other public speakers from harassment and threats. Cyberstalking is a crime, and as the Supreme Court has made clear, threats of violence are not protected speech. So, Scott, here's where I would ask Tim, what do you mean by those threats of violence? I mean, is it when Donald Trump and Dave Weigel are tangling on Twitter and Trump's supporters go after Dave Weigel and some say vaguely threatening things, is that a legally actionable threat or is that just social media idiocy? You know, I mean, I don't know what Tim is exactly saying
there. Well, you know, it's funny. I read that and I thought that was not a particularly huge leap in the sense of I think everyone would agree when it's a clear threat and your question asks that, what exactly is and isn't a clear threat? And that's very difficult. It's very contextual. You know, something that somebody across the country sends to you, you know, at 2 p.m. doesn't particularly feel concerning. Whereas if somebody you know is, you know, 3 miles away or 3 doors away could be very concerning. But I felt like that was, you know, a very standard thing that we do now, which is we don't tolerate threats. You know, threats are not protected by the First Amendment. And law enforcement, you know, calling law enforcement, calling people who have been victimized to act is, you know, is a very standard and good thing to do.
All right. Well, and then what else should we do? He writes, at a minimum, new rules should bar social media companies from accepting money for political advertising by foreign governments or their agents. That's one I'll get to his next idea in a moment here. But let's stay hyper-focused on that. Scott, are there legal mechanisms there? And do you think he's right to say we should bar social media companies from taking money for political advertising by foreign governments or their agents?
You know, and that's a really tough one. I mean, I'm not a campaign law finance expert by any means, and I would say, you know, that's the first place we're going to look. And the reason is because, you know, and this is no offense to Mr. Wu, it's, you know, he's got limited space to write that, but how does that actually shake out in practice? You know, if you're an individual selling the latest product and you come from you know, a country that does not have a democracy, do we not take your money because it, you know, versus something paid for, you know, with a check with a leader's signature on it where we say, well, that's very different. I think the devil's in the details.
Okay. Jack, any thoughts there?
Yeah, same thing. It's like, how do you decide what's legitimate to accept and what's not legitimate? You know, what constitutes political advertising versus what's, you know,
too much of a slippery slope
And also, I think we want to have a technical discussion, in which Mr. Wu is supremely capable at, to say, how are these things happening? Because social media always morphs. 6 months from now, it's going to be very different. And we want to say, what's the next step? What are the concerns we should have? Is it the bots versus humans from a different locale?
Yeah, and Wu writes also, quote, more aggressive anti-bot laws are needed to fight impersonation of humans for propaganda purposes, end quote. Can you create a law like that, Scott?
Well, it's actually interesting. Right now, Attorney General Schneiderman is investigating whether individuals' identities have been used to comment on the FCC's website about net neutrality. And I believe his office has created a tool where folks can go in and see if someone has bogarted their identity to make comments that presumably are fake on the FCC website. So there's a good example of, you know, an existing set of rules being utilized to deal with, you know, that kind of concept. So I think that's where, again, where I'd look first, because you always have to be concerned about, as you write a law, does the technology quickly outpace it?
All right, so let me ask both of our guests about the counterpoint in Cato Unbound today by John Samples in a piece about social media and the First Amendment's values. And so much of it is about self-expression. Samples writes, quote, Emerson remarked that Western thought assumes that the proper end of man is the realization of his character and potentialities as a human being. This implies that every person has the right to form their own beliefs and opinions, along with the right to express both. This path toward self-realization demands the freedom to know and speak, and makes society a servant of individuals rather than their master. On this front, social media is an unalloyed good. Not since the invention of the printing press have we seen such a radical expansion of the individual's capacity for self-fulfillment through self-expression. Until just a few years ago, the cost of speaking scaled quite rapidly with audience size. In order to address anything larger than a suburban dinner party or passers-by on the street, one had to book a hall, compete for a number of limited time slots on public access television, or devote huge resources toward developing specialized credentials. The larger your intended audience, the greater the opportunity cost. The internet, and social media in particular, has leveled this playing field. A speaker may address many as easily as she might talk to one. In this new environment, the reach of a speaker is limited only by the attention of prospective listeners. End quote. And he goes on to conclude that, yes, there may be some issues here and there, but on balance, he thinks social media has been a boon to the First Amendment and speech as we know it. Jack, what do you think?
I think there's a lot to be said for all those perspectives. And so it comes back to what I was saying kind of at the top of the hour, that it's really a question of norms and what do people use this freedom, this tool, this ability, what do they use it for? Is it to share cat videos? Is it to, you know, engage in political polemics? And you know, the answer, of course, is all of the above. We see all of this happening. You know, in terms of political discourse, I always come back to the idea that, you know, we're all entitled to our own opinion, but we are not all entitled to our own set of facts. There should be a common set of facts underlying what we express our opinions about. And, you know, social media, and this, I think, goes back to a lot of things that we've been talking about for the past hour, that, you know, social media undermines to some degree that base of facts, because it's hard to tell what's real and what's not in terms of what people purport to be a factual statement.
Hmm. I want to know what Jack has against cat videos.
Hey, they need to be banned. We have enough. We've reached our quota.
I tell my students, you know, most of what you see on my Twitter feed is professional, but I do tweet at the occasional picture of my cat, because if I don't, my rights to use the internet will be taken away from me.
Scott, some thoughts on what Samples is saying for Cato there.
Yeah, no, I think he's got a really good point, which is, you know, you can use this tool and get to a huge audience. But the challenge comes in, it's not the speaker that really should be our focus. It's the listener and how, or the reader, and how are they using it? Kind of the rule I like to say is, you know, if you're reading something and it's too good to be true, you know, or you can't identify where the speaker is from within about 10 seconds of reading it, then that's where you should be a little more skeptical, you know, and that to me is the really important point. So I think he's closer to correct than you know, Professor Wu is, but, you know, we shouldn't go too far on either side.
Okay, and let me close the hour by bringing up something that we're going to talk a lot more about as we head towards the fall, because in the fall of 2018, Cornell Law School is launching its new First Amendment clinic. And according to a release from Cornell, they plan to have students take a look at free speech cases that are ongoing, sort of analyze the news gathering process, look at, you know, policy analysis, research, even advocacy, and look at free speech from a wide range of angles. Scott, as an attorney, does that interest you? Are you curious to see what they end up doing with that?
I'm really interested to see, you know, right now there's probably a ton of First Amendment cases that economically don't get to go forward. And I think there are not going to be that many social media cases, but I think you're going to see a lot of employment cases in, you know, in the workplace, you know, particularly a public workplace where the First Amendment does apply. And I think you're going to see a lot of cases coming out of small jurisdictions where maybe it's a town that's doing something that people don't like. So I'm really interested to see how it shakes out and also how they continue and what they do in their 5-year mission, to steal a popular phrase.
Jack, what do you think?
I've focus sort of on the word clinic when I saw that article, and I wonder if it means they're going to be doing some of that media literacy education you had talked about to help people understand that, you know, the First Amendment doesn't just apply to journalists. It really applies to all of us, and it's for the benefit of all of us, and it protects both individual rights of expression, but it also is sort of the main tool to guarantee a set of public discourse that benefits us as a society. That was Justice Brennan's view in a famous libel case that relied on the First Amendment, that it's, you know, it's about making sure we have a public discourse that is protected by the First Amendment that's valuable to us all.
Well, I want to thank our guest for the hour, Jack Rosenberry, Professor of Media and Communication at St. John Fisher College. Jack, always nice to have you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Evan.
ScottMalouf.com, M-A-L-O-U-F, ScottMalouf.com. He's a social media attorney. Always appreciate the expertise in the background. Thank you, Scott.
Well, thanks for not asking hard questions, Evan.
Wait a second. That says I'm a softballer. You just called me a softballer. That is, you thought you were...
Context.
Thank you. I don't know what to make of that. We're going to break. I'm going to figure that out. We'll be back.